Hidden History and Archaeology, Dr. Heather Lynn with us. A couple of her books, Land of the Watchers, The Sumerian Controversy, and her website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is drheatherlynn.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, Dr. Heather Lynn with us. Heather, let's get into some more of these artifacts and what's been going on. The Baghdad Museum during the Iraqi War got raided, looted, some incredible artifacts. Where'd they go?
Wouldn't we all like to know? There have been some that were recovered and given back, but some of them are still missing to this day. I spoke with somebody who told me that this is really interesting. This is something to consider. You know, when you hear looters, a lot of times it's just easy to think about people just crashing into windows or, you know, running in and just grabbing things. But these people who looted the Baghdad Museum, they were smart enough to know which exhibits had replicas. They passed right over the fakes. They knew what they were looking for. They not only took the real artifacts, they were somehow able to remove the, like, very heavy statues, indicating they probably had some kind of heavy equipment to do this. So this was very organized. Some of the storage rooms where the actual artifacts were kept, they were all locked. Well, they weren't broken into by force. They were unlocked using keys. So clearly, this was an organized thing. They had keys. They had knowledge of what they were looking for specifically. They knew not to get the replicas. And again, they had the machinery, the tools, everything to go in there cleanly, pretty much, and grab what they wanted and get out of there.
Okay, so they took what they needed. And again, you and I both believe some very wealthy people probably have them. Do you think the looting may have been orchestrated by some of these rich people?
You know, it may be controversial to say that, but I would have to say yes, absolutely. I think that there is a huge possibility that people like that were behind it because they have the means, they have the motivation. They want these things in their personal, you know, collections for a host of different reasons. They want to feel the power from them. And some of these people have, from what I understand, very interesting or eccentric beliefs about what some of these artifacts actually mean to them. So, you know, some of them think that if they have these artifacts, that it may give them some sense of power, some sense of, and when I say power, I don't just mean in this world, but some kind of a otherworldly power. So one thing in particular that, I know is being actively searched for through these black market channels is the Sumerian artifact called the Tablet of Destinies.
What is that?
The Tablet of Destinies is, well, first of all, there are no real good descriptions about what it is. I mean, clearly it's a tablet, hence the name, but nobody has any idea if there's more than one, if there's, you know, if it's big, if it's little, if what. So it's basically a tablet that is a legal doctrine. It's sort of like, you know, because they didn't have paper, clearly, so they had to use the tablets, and they did this in a lot of different ways when they recorded general taxes or transactions or whatever. So like any other document that would be legally binding, this Tablet of Destinies was considered that very thing, except this one was different because it was bestowed upon the kings of Sumer by the gods themselves. So whomever had this Tablet of Destinies in their possession supposedly could have the power to rule the entire universe. In addition to ruling the universe, they had the ability to know what happened in the past, what happens in the present all around them, in places they couldn't see with their own eyes, and they would have the ability to see in the future. So this would give them a sort of all-knowing, all-seeing ability, making them very, very much like the gods.
with some of these super wealthy people doing what they're doing, do you think, and I just threw out mentioning the Ark of the Covenant, what about the Holy Grail, the cup, basically, the chalice that they say Jesus drank from?
Well, I think that's just another example of these artifacts that for a long time pick up a legend. And the legend usually centers around whoever has whatever the artifact is going to have these super magical powers, and it's somehow going to legitimize their, you know, current powerful position and thereby make them more powerful. So I think just like the Holy Grail, I think something like the Tablet of Destinies is definitely included in this, in that it's just this overall thinking that, you know, if we get our hands on this, this will make us, at least symbolically, you know, more powerful.
Yes.
So I think it's more of a question of symbolism than anything else. But to in all fairness, I think there are definitely people out there that have become so detached from reality due to, you know, having excessive means that they begin to believe, genuinely believe these things.
That it's going to make them powerful.
Yeah, that it's
godlike, right?
God, exactly. That it's going to make them godlike. So,
what do you think, Heather, got some of these very wealthy families and individuals into, you know, this collection of artifacts? And I mean, is it because they've got so much money that they're bored and they don't have anything else to do?
I think to some extent that would be a logical conclusion, but I think that, I think that it's not always the case. I know some people that I've spoken with who say, who are actually part of some of these families, who say they don't agree with how so-and-so is now running things, and, you know, maybe they're a bit disgruntled. So, you know, you can only take what they're saying for what it's worth that way. But from my understanding, it can kind of turn into more of a almost religious-type belief. So
Obsession.
And something deeply spiritually motivated.
How far will some of these people go? No names mentioned. I mean, would they kill other people to get to what they want?
Yes, undoubtedly.
Wow. Have you heard of that specifically?
Yes, I have. I worked on a project with a professor who did a lot of work. I write about him in my book, Land of the Watchers. He was an awesome, awesome fellow. He used to work in Afghanistan before Afghanistan got into the situation that it is now.
What a mess, yeah.
A total mess. And his perspective, and he's fascinating, his perspective was a lot different. But I do know he told me a lot of stories about the things that had happened to, you know, colleagues of his in the 70s and whatnot. But I also know that the way he was treated for speaking out, he was very much a renegade archaeologist as well, although he was still working within the university system. He was just very, you know, vocal about things, and he ended up, getting, I guess, removed from his position. And, so he went down a sad road, and then, other things happened with him. But for the most part, I have heard so many things about so many specific events where it's really well known that once you get to a certain point in academia, you either have to accept it and be part of it, or duck your head, just don't, you know, look the other way, and get out. And I think it's just with that. I don't think it's necessarily something with academia as much as it is with institutions that are that large. Anytime you have...
Are you there? Uh-oh. We might have to get you back. Let me try this again here. You with us, Heather?
I'm here.
There you
can
go.
You hear me?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where you went. Could you hear me?
Yeah, I could hear you just
from
fine.
The get-go. No, you went to this. But Tom, we got her. We got her now. She's back. But Tommy came running in here to save the day. But I don't know where you went, but I'm glad you're back with us.
I don't know.
Maybe it's those super people.
The powers that be.
They're out there. They clipped your phone, huh?
Maybe so. I wouldn't doubt it. I don't know. It sounds a little tinfoil hat of me to say this, but I have had some interesting run-ins. I
would really?
Say.
Well,
really.
You don't, do you name names?
I do name names.
Ah, you got to be careful, Heather.
I know. I learned this lesson in the Sumerian controversy. I named names and gave every detail imaginable. And, you know, I got a lot of contacts after that, some good and some very bad. When I was working on Land of the Watchers, I was actually contacted by an attorney for the oil lobby who said that they, well, actually demanded that I submit my manuscript for Land of the Watchers to them before printing.
Huh.
And I said, that's crazy talk. I'm not doing that. I think they were just trying to, you know, intimidate me. But as a result, I did, in Land of the Watchers, change a few names of the individual people, and definitely whistleblowers and people like that I don't at all name, you know, for their safety. But I think that is, you know, I've had hacking incidences. I've had everything you can imagine go on. And so I was not really a believer in any of that, so to speak, until this has started to happen to me, especially after this report. So it was a whole new rabbit hole I fell into.
You sure did. I'm glad you fell out of it, too.
Yeah, I crawled out the best I could.
You had mentioned earlier that a lot of oil and mining companies are involved in the archaeological research and in some cases funding. What are they trying to get out of this?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I've been
it's
asked
weird.
A lot. It is weird. I think it's definitely strange. I mean, you could look at it like, well, they're trying to do philanthropy, or, you know, maybe they're trying. No, I don't buy that at all, because, you know, philanthropy, everybody does that. It's just, it's a PR move. So I don't believe it in any way that they're just out there trying to do research and all this. So what is it that they're looking for? Some people have said, well, they're looking for lost technology, or maybe some sort of, you know, I've actually heard Stargates or any of these things. And, you know, I really couldn't tell you until I got in touch with somebody from one of these companies. They got in touch with me. And it was somebody who had a position that was, you know, fairly high up. They said that they had to have security clearance. So I don't know the extent of their position. They didn't really divulge that specific detail, but they said for their position they had to have security clearance, which I didn't even realize necessarily was a thing when you worked in like a private sector job. So, you know, I learned later that, yeah, that was a thing. So it came as a surprise to me. What he told me was that there are discussions within the industry about finding a new type of oil, a new type of substance. And so I'm thinking, is this some kind of new, you know, clean burning fuel, or is this, you know, what is this? He actually said it was some kind of oil from the mountains, but that it wasn't going to be used necessarily for burning fuel as much as it would be for pharmaceuticals. I thought, well, that's different. Okay. And so, you know, after listening to him, I decided to research that a little bit more, and I found in my personal study of the Sumerian texts a lot of references to mountain oil. And so,
and what is that, a specific company?
The mountain oil is it's actually written in the Sumerian text. So the
mountain oil, is it a product?
I guess
is it like olive oil, but it's called mountain oil?
Sort of. There's not a lot written. A lot of the pieces on the tablet are, you know, conveniently gone, as most of those things are. Whenever you get to the good stuff, the, you know, it's cracked or it's gone. But this mountain oil they speak of was used in a lot of rituals and ceremony, but it was used for healing purposes. And they believe, the Sumerians believe, that this particular mountain oil, it was oil that they could get from the mountains. The mountains were a very sacred place to the gods. So this was like godly oil. So, you know, it's more of a, I guess like a ritual ceremony kind of thing to burn, but it was also something to use for healing. And I don't really think that anything indicates that it was like, we have a wound and we'll rub this on it and it'll get better. It was more of like a spiritual healing, and it was yet another thing that was supposed to grant eternal life. So essentially, this mountain oil would have been another version of an elixir of life.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the elite and the wealthy are looking for, and I think it's immortality. They want to be Highlanders. They want to live forever, don't they?
I believe that that is exactly what it is. I think that when, like you mentioned before, once you have so much money and so much power, I mean, what's next?
They're bored.
You're bored, right? So at some point, you think, well, I don't really have it all unless I have, you know, the status of being God. So you have this search for all of these symbolic artifacts that could somehow give them immortality, essentially, and a more godlike status. And so, absolutely.
Heather, when you started doing this, did you expect all of this to unfold the way it has?
Absolutely not. No, not in any way, shape, or form. I just, you know, when I said I was a renegade, I really never thought about going in these directions. It's always been there. I've always been interested in alternative ideas, but I've only just entertained them, not very seriously. I think this all started back when I was an undergraduate, and I got very, very much interested in some of these alternative ideas, and I ended up contacting Michael Cremo.
I know him well. Good guy.
Yeah, I think I heard him on your show, so I was very intrigued with what he had to say, and I really respected his work because it was, you know, very scholarly, very interesting, and a little bit controversial. So I ended up contacting him, and I was surprised when he emailed me back and gave me some of the best advice, and I took that advice and ran with it. His advice was that, you know, if I stayed in the mainstream, I could only really make a difference slightly by pushing the envelope, little by little, and that was fine. That was an option. But if I left the mainstream, I would be able to sort of, you know, put out new discoveries or new ideas, new ways of looking at things or what have you, but you know, I would have to pretty much prepare myself for the potential backlash. And so he really didn't favor one idea over the other. He was very impartial and gave me a very well thought out, you know, answer. And it's just something that I sat on and thought, you know, that's good to know. And it just, I didn't act on anything. I mean, perhaps I did because I stayed as long as I did, but I ended up always thinking, you know, this is true. I'm going to try to push the envelope, but it wasn't happening, and it wasn't happening fast enough. So I definitely decided, you know what, forget it. I'm going rogue, I'm going out, and I'm doing this. But I never thought in a million years that some of these alternative theories may actually have a sentiment of truth to them. And what has surprised me, I think, throughout this whole process, this whole journey, especially with Land of the Watchers, it has been the whistleblower testimony. I was so surprised at who contacted me. And even now, I'm not quite sure what their motives have been for contacting me, because it's not just been the average person. I've had lots of that. But then I've also had people who were heads of huge companies, heads of government, and the only thing I can think is maybe they're thinking, well, we'll keep our enemies close. You know? I don't know, but usually when they contact me, they're very much like, oh no, this is true.
All right, hold on, Heather. I want to talk with you about the work of Zechariah Sitchin and the Anunnaki when we come back. Heather, one of our dear guests, the late Zechariah Sitchin, wrote a number of books called The Earth Chronicles, where he chronicled, of course, the story of the Anunnaki, that a planet in our solar system called Nibiru would come around every 3,600 years, and that they came here to mine gold. They needed it to sprinkle into their atmosphere, gold dust and particles. What do you think of that theory, and what have you been able to uncover with some of your work?
Well, you know, I think that there's an underlying truth to the vision of Sitchin. But I just think that the term extraterrestrial now conjures up images of little green men or retro outdated technology and things that are more science fiction oriented. You know, based on my research, I would be more apt to say that these beings were not necessarily extraterrestrial biological beings, as some may describe, but rather sort of interdimensional, vibrational type beings, something that, you know, something more akin to a spiritual being, a demon, an angel, or any of these terms that people use commonly now. I think that that would be more apropos in this situation. I mean, I don't think that you can all out say that he was wrong. I think that Sitchin's work is definitely a springboard for new ideas. And so I just don't think it should stop there. I think that is the problem a lot of people, you know, have, is that they have more of like a cult following. But Sitchin himself, you know, wanted to be considered as an academic. He wanted to do his work in a scholarly way.
Sure.
You know, and so to just sort of follow him and not question him and not build on his research, I think lowers the standard that he was working for. And it isn't a very good thing to honor his work or memory.
What do you think? I want you to kind of give us a scenario of what this planet was like a long time ago, and what do you think happened to it?
Well, a long time ago is in the ancient Mesopotamia.
Yeah, right about there, hundreds of thousands of years old.
Well, I think that there's a difference in our understanding of what it means to be civilization. I mean, we have a lot of talk about the big sort of bang thing that happened. They call it sometimes the big brain bang. What happened to man to make man civilized? Why did all of a sudden these inventions start to appear? You know, what happened? And so this is something that I go into a little bit in Land of the Watchers, this idea that, you know, you have places like Göbekli Tepe, that's still considered, you know, not necessarily a civilization as much as it's considered a settlement. And there's a big difference there. A civilization is usually considered something that has high technology, you know, for their time, something that has structure and government and rules and systems in place. And that's something that you see just sort of seeming to just appear out of nowhere in Mesopotamia. Now, it's really a mystery still. I mean, from my general training, I would say that irrigation is the mainstream answer. It's they came across first irrigation, and then that led to sort of a snowball effect between having, you know, increased food supply and increased workforce and then increased need for middle management and then systems, and they had to teach and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think there's just a missing component to that. And I don't think I can say definitely that, well, then it's definitely aliens, because I think that has become one of those, you know, go-to answers. And so I think that the mystery still remains, but I am one of those people that believes that there's more to the story and that it needs to be actively researched. What is it? What was that single event that seemingly launched this whole change in human development that we see happening in Sumer?
And why that region? Cradle of civilization, why there?
Well, you know, I think the best way to explain that would still be more of a mainstream approach. You know, the idea of us coming out of Africa and that region was, you know, very lush at the time. I mean, it had great, once they were able to have irrigation and sort of, you know, figure these things out, they were able to harness this natural power and really make almost a Garden of Eden, something that at the time would have been unheard of. They had hanging gardens, they had, you know, all kinds of wealth. And so I think it was just having to do more so with the geographic region, the climate, all the agricultural possibilities that were there. I don't think that there's any necessarily like a magical reason for it being, you know, Mesopotamia. I think it just happens to be because it was a area rich and fertile.
Where does your work take you next? What do you do?
Well, you know, I just put out Land of the Watchers, and that one left me a little bit shaken because, like I said, I had a lot of people contacting me from that, but I don't feel that I was able to clearly identify all the answers that I, you know, am looking for in this situation in Land of the Watchers. And I know a lot of people have since written to me and they want to know, you know, more. And so these are things I'm going to be actively pursuing, you know, in the coming months and hopefully not years, but I've actually moved on to a new project. I'm writing a book called Evil Archaeology.
Evil Archaeology.
Yeah, it's about sinister artifacts and haunted relics and the curses and different things like that. So
there are some spots, I guess, around this planet that could be cursed, don't you think?
You know, I don't know, but there are different places you may go where you just get that creepy feeling that somebody's watching you, or you get a chill at the back of your neck and you can't explain it. And then sometimes, you know, people have described those same feelings happening when they hold certain artifacts or relics. So, you know, antique shops can be pretty spooky sometimes.
Are there some regions of this planet that archaeologists just should not go?
Well, no, I would say they should go anywhere they can. But if you wanted to be more superstitious, then maybe you could say a lot of places in the Middle East, because that, those are the places that, you know, have the association with the demons, how the Christian demons sort of came from the Mesopotamian demons and deities that way. So that's why we have in the movie The Exorcist, there is that whole beginning sequence where the archaeologist slash priest goes out and sees the statue of Pazuzu, the ancient, you know, Sumerian demon. So that was supposedly the spirit that possessed the girl in The Exorcist. And so, you know, I think that if you look at it from a maybe Western or Christian perspective, you could definitely say there's a creep factor to going around and digging up some of these, you know, biblical demons.
Maybe so. Maybe so. When you were doing this, and you probably thought archaeology was going to be fascinating and fun and different, I bet you didn't anticipate any of this stuff, did you?
I didn't at all. I didn't foresee any of this happening. I just, you know, like I said, I was naive. And I didn't realize how deep the corruption went, and it's not, but it's not necessarily a bad ending to it all. I don't think that there's an end to this. I think this is more of a cautionary tale. I think that we really have to wake up to these things and do something about it. We're not powerless here, you know. I think that spreading the word and becoming a little more aware of what's going on with history is vitally important. So, you know, history belongs to all of us. It doesn't just belong to the 1%. And at this rate, this is what they want. They want the history to belong to them, because as the old, you know, quote goes from Orwell, who controls the past controls the future, and who controls the present controls the past. And that's exactly their motive.
What other incredible possible discoveries are out there on the horizon, Heather? I mean, I just talked about Sodom, from Sodom and Gomorrah, that city. They think they may have uncovered that. I mean, it's amazing how they're able to find these things, which also tells me that ancient myths could very well be real stories.
Well, indeed, because for the longest, they thought that Troy was a myth until, you know, they did find that. So I think that we're seeing a different time now, a sort of an awakening in archaeology and just studies like this in general, maybe because of increased, you know, technology, I would imagine. But people are finding things that they've never found before, never thought they could. So, yeah, I think that it's almost limitless what we're going to be able to find. But I did notice that it seems like recently a lot of focus and energies have gone into biblical archaeology, and a lot of things like that are being, you know, uncovered.
Why
now.
Do you think that is?
You know, I think there's just more of a passion, more of a motivation to go search for those types of things. I think that again, it deals with sort of the who's funding it, who's interested in it, and at the end of the day, it really does come down to passion, whether it's on the part of the individual archaeologist or who's funding or somewhere, there has to be something more than just the notion that you want to dig something up and research it and then give that out to better humanity and so on and so forth. That doesn't drive people. What drives people is passion. So I think there just happens to be more of a passion for things that are religious in nature.
Well, I think so too. Are you still enjoying yourself? I mean, you still call yourself an archaeologist?
Yes, I do. You know, I go on, you know, excavations here and there. I do more local things and help out where I can. You know, I'm planning a few excursions for the summer. So I do still work. I just don't work in the mainstream, so to speak. I have an organization called the Society for Truth and Archaeological Research. And what we do there is we try to do a more interdisciplinary approach to you know, the study of history. And so it's open to anybody, including independent researchers, and it's a, you know, free membership and that kind of thing. So I just, you know, I decided to point my energies into doing something positive, something that I could, you know, maybe make a change for the better.
Heather, with your work, The Land of the Watchers, who are the Watchers?
The Watchers. That is the big question in the book. I would say that, you know, there's a lot of theories about the Watchers. Are they the Nephilim? Are they, you know, extraterrestrial? Who are these Watchers? What I have actually found, there are a lot of good reasons to believe that through the past, the ideas of angels and, you know, these gods or whoever, this Watcher, is sort of a catch-all. It can be almost anybody or anything, and so it changes and evolves through time and cultures. But the difference is, I spoke with some people, and I talk up detail about this in the book. This idea of the Watcher has been taken on as something that the elites find to be, you know, more descriptive of what they want to be. They look up to the idea that they could be all-seeing, all-knowing, you know, omnipotent. And so within them, there is a group called the Watchers. And so I go a little more into that in the book and what it is that these self-described Watchers would like to do and why they're funding some of this work that we see in the Middle East especially.
What's the downside to some of this? I mean, can some of this implode around us? I mean, is there any danger here with what's been going on?
I think there definitely is, because what we see is just this great shift in power. I mean, archaeology is an important tool of influence. And if it weren't the case, then ISIS wouldn't be destroying ancient world heritage sites and killing scholars. You know, archaeological discoveries are widely sources of national pride and have the power to unify populations. And so, you know, if you were to systematically erase the past, you can control the future by filling in the blanks with whatever you want people to believe. And, you know, that's the weaponization of history.
So as you look at all the things that you've done as a writer, historian, archaeologist, what would you say for you has been the single most satisfying moment?
Wow, that's a great question. The single most satisfying moment.
That really got you to just say, I love doing what I'm doing.
You know, I get that feeling. I don't think it's been one. I think I get that feeling every time I get an email from somebody who says to me, you know, I really appreciate what you do, and because of this and because now I'm aware of these things, I want to go out and do something about it. I want to go out and volunteer in, you know, the community, do some local archaeology, because, you know, that's what I'm trying to tell people, is that if you sit back and let everybody else do these things, then, you know, you're being controlled. You have to take, you know, you have to take it on yourself. And there are lots of ways to get involved actively in archaeology. You don't have to, you know, get on a plane to Machu Picchu. You don't have to do any of these things. You can find opportunities within your own community to be more hands-on in history. And so I think Yeah, I'm happiest when I get emails that say, you know what, whatever you've said or whatever I've read that you've said has motivated me to get out there and do something positive.
When you ever go on an archaeological dig, you obviously need to get what? Permission from the country and gosh knows how many permits?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have to have permission from the localities, from everybody. So it's logistically difficult and usually very expensive.
I was going to say, how much does a dig cost? I mean, to find a city like Sodom, how long would that take and how much would that cost just to go through that process?
Well, those numbers, they vary, but I would say that if in the Sodom scenario, I believe they were there at least 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so they've been there working for a while.
I mean, did they know they had something 10 years ago?
Probably thought so at the time. What you have to do is you have to sort of be onto something, and you have to, you know, make a research proposal. You have to propose these ideas and then in order to get funding. And you only get the funding for about a year. You know, so then you have to show, hey, you know, I did what I said I was going to do with the money that you gave me, and now look, we're going to take it to this next level, and I need X amount of money, and so it builds upon that. So it can go from, you know, you could do something locally in a community, a small scale dig for maybe $5,000, if not less, sometimes less. But when you're talking something on a much greater scale, like the Sodom, I mean, it could be tens of thousands a year, if not hundreds of thousands. It just really depends on what's involved. Especially if you're in the Middle East, a lot of times you have to have, you know, so much more protection and logistics and security. So it can be very expensive.
Who owns the artifacts that are uncovered? The investor, or do they have to go to the country?
I think that is an excellent question that I don't think anybody really has the answer to, or anybody wants to, you know, step up and answer. It would stand to reason that the person who paid for it would, you know, have that. But no, I believe that it is ethically, it belongs to all of us in a way, but it should stay in the location where it was found. It should be given to, you know, the locals as a source of national pride. And the argument a lot of times for not doing that is, well, they're so unstable. You know, we can't trust that, whatever. We'll just hold on to these for you until you get your act together, you know, but then they never get back. They never get delivered. Every year, museums are being sued by other countries. You know, museums are just suing each other all over the place to get artifacts shipped back to them, you know, and it is something that we don't want to talk about a lot of times in this industry. And, you know, but you can go right now into the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. and walk through one of the newer exhibits they have, the Hall of Origins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not the Hall of Origins, it's the Koch Hall of Origins, because it was founded by a Koch brother. It was funded by him completely. So, that, you know, it's all corporate. It's part of
sure
the history industrial complex.
We're going to take some phone calls, Heather, when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.